This is tape two, side one, Gus Schubert interview 11791. That's, I guess, another potential issue besides the quality of the assumptions that go into such a study is the base of initial data that you have from which you extrapolate. And I get the impression from reading some of Bert Klein's stuff that that was another kind of concern of his about systems analysis. Is that something that you saw as an issue as well?
Well, I think we shared a view that in itself was internally inconsistent. Bert and I and others recognize that there's no such thing as a perfect data set. So that any data set you used or generated was bound to have problems with it. If you're dealing with reality and human beings and decisions that are made by them. On the other hand, very often there were studies that were done with no data at all, or very close to no data at all. So that the information was very, very partial and much, much, much more partial than it needed to be. And I think we tended to be much more empirical and much more insistent on if you couldn't find a data set somewhere, then you went out and you generated the data set. And there was a lot of that done during the R&D and procurement work. In which Bert and others spent time out in the field actually observing the manufacture of airplanes and talking with people like Kelly Johnson at the Skunk Works and talking with people who were actively engaged in building missiles under the concurrency system and trying to put together a meaningful database, which was on the one hand kind of quantitative, as quantitative as we can make it, but we did not reject experiential evidence. When Bert and I did a study on space operations, which actually grew out of a dispute we had with the engineering department about where the real cost of space systems was likely to lie, in the hardware procurement or in the test operations and maintenance area. Bert and I argued without knowing anything that it was much more likely to be the latter than the former, and the engineers argued that it was much more logical to lie in the hardware. And we thought that was a real issue, and so we decided to find out what the facts were, and we looked around, and while we could find procurement costs for these missiles or boosters, we could not find any data whatsoever on operations, test, maintenance costs for these things, except a bunch of assumptions. So we spent a lot of time out at down at the Cape and up at Vandenberg and at Convair and at Boeing, and so on and so forth, trying to understand what it costs to set up one. After you bought this thing, what does it cost to get it out on a pad, to make it operational, to test it, and then while it's in the silo or on the pad, to maintain it, and so on and so forth. And we found that, I guess it's something like two-thirds of the cost really lay in that second sphere as opposed to the first, which was a great surprise to a lot of people. And the authors of that were Bert and I and Don Lewis, as I remember. And we did our work and we published our report and we sat back as a typical Rand fashion of the time, waiting for the thundering applause to occur. And, of course, we were met with the usual typical response, that is dead silence, and which which I got have to say, we really didn't notice because we went on to something else. But there was a colonel in this place at the time, an Air Force liaison officer, who read this report. And he thought it was an extremely important report and that it had all kinds of implications, which it did, for the way in which operations, tests, maintenance, and so on were conducted, and presented all kinds of opportunities for saving vast amounts of money and increasing the effectiveness of the space booster program. So he took this thing out and made himself into a salesman of the first, the high-pressure used car salesman. He went everywhere, from Washington to all the SAC bases and this base and that base, NASA, everywhere else, waving this report around and saying, you've got to read this, and giving briefings and so on. And the first thing we knew, we were in there briefing Hugh Dryden at NASA, and we were briefing the air staff, and we were briefing this and briefing that. And the study, because of this colonel, just the accident of this colonel having read it, the study really did have a tremendous impact, because 2 years later, Don Lewis and I on our own did a follow-up study and asked the question, you know, did this study make any difference? Did it change the world in any way? And in fact, we found that it had. The particulars are now, you know, obviously very cloudy in my mind. We're talking about the early 60s.
Right.
But incidentally, that's one of the few times I know that Rand has gone out and said, did we make a difference? The other time I know I'm aware of is with the ICJ, when we founded that in the domestic division. We had a formal evaluation, externally conducted, sponsored by foundation funds, of the Institute for Civil Justice and its program, and whether it was making any difference, whether it was worth continuing, and if so, what ought to be changed. I think Rand should do more of that. But the lesson there was, relating to your point about data, was most of the data about the operational test and maintenance phase of boosterism, space boosterism, were data gathered by us at the site, primarily Cape Canaveral slash Kennedy, slash Canaveral. I guess it was still Kennedy when we were doing most of our work there, and but also at Vandenberg, and then at the manufacturers, and then contrasting the Navy and its practices with the Air Force and its practices as best we could, trying to understand where the what was going on and where the costs were being incurred. And we came back with our data and analyzed them, and then had the procurement data, put the two sets together, and were able to make that comparison. So we were strong believers. The data were not perfect, of course, they never are, but they were a lot more complete than anything that had ever been gathered before. Another example of that kind of study is a study done by Robert Summers, who is an economist. He was here as a consultant. He's at the University of Pennsylvania, and he did a study of the cost of missile procurement, or the cost of procurement. And he was asking the question of if you contract for a system on today, what can you expect the final cost to be? And again, that was a very, Bob is a very meticulous and very empirically oriented person. And he went out and gathered all the data necessary to answer that question with regard to, I know, the Minuteman and maybe one or two other major Air Force systems, and showed the set of curves of cost increase which could be used to make intelligent decisions about, you know, the impact of what you decide today is likely to have in the future in terms of the cost you're likely to actually incur and the money you're going to have to lay out. And I think that study is still a small classic, although it received much more academic attention for its elegance than it did Air Force attention, I think, for its utility. I think it had both. But it suffered from one of the RAM shortcomings, which is that it was, as I recall anyway, very difficult to understand, to read and to understand and say, I really get the message. It was highly mathematical. It was full of all sorts of curves up, down, sidewise, and I could see people's eyes glaze over as they opened the first page. And Bob was not a briefer, and I think he probably never briefed the study. But as I recall, it was an excellent journal article.
Okay. What you described there are a couple of cases where it was really possible to go out and gather the data. But when you look at areas of work where RAND has had most public attention, especially in nuclear strategy, and the ins and outs of how you make a decision about what your government policy ought to be in that area, the ability to gather data becomes a very difficult exercise, and essentially, I think, in many cases, is impossible. So maybe in that context, it might be useful to say to talk about the work of somebody like Herman Kahn, which you had some familiarity with, in which there was a lot of assumptions that were the principal thing you were working with and trying to make some decisions about which way to go. The first way to get started on this would be to kind of maybe tie it back to our discussion about what Frank thought was good and what Frank thought was bad. Did he have some, one of the things that were important to him was that the data had, there was some data there that was reasonably concrete that you were working with? Was that, I wonder whether one of that was one of his responses to the systems analysis people, the distinction between having a solid set of data and not having one.
Well, I do think that was important to him, but again, I never heard him say that. I can only infer that from his behavior. With regard to the two different kinds of studies, you're absolutely right. There are many cases in which data simply don't exist, and you just have to make assumptions. And there, it seems to me that the best of studies make a range of assumptions, all of them reasonable, but they can be quite different from one another and still be reasonable. And then the study will point out it will, in essence, in systems analysis terms, do a sensitivity analysis. Suppose this assumption turns out to be wrong, what does that do to the conclusion? Suppose this one turns out to be wrong, what does that do to the conclusion? In fact, sensitivity analysis is now a standard part of the systems analyst kit for just the reason you suggest.
Right.
You're forced from lack of data to make assumptions, and while they're all reasonable, that doesn't mean that any of them is right. And so the key question then becomes not which one is right, because you can't tell that, but what difference does it make if they're wrong? And I think that sort of thing was something that Frank admired very much. Somebody who would be willing to say, I made seven assumptions, and any reasonable man would agree with any one of them, but there's no way to tell which of them's right, so I'm going to run them all through the system. And then I'm going to analyze what the overall effect is if you select this one versus that one, and which tends to illuminate choices rather than make choices, and is a perfectly legitimate thing to do, in my opinion. Where you get in trouble is where you make a set of assumptions and you don't make them explicit, and you don't test the sensitivity of the results to the assumptions, and you know, the methodology is kind of obscure, so you can't really see the link between the assumptions and conclusions. And that's the kind of thing that nobody likes to see happen, but it does happen from time to time. And that's the kind of thing that would irritate Frank, you know, drive him right up the wall, and drove a good many of his RAND colleagues right up the wall.
I wonder whether we might kind of refer to example. I don't know whether you recall this. I found these in Amram Katz's papers, and there are some D's that refer to a something called the National Security Seminar, which was back in the early 60s, and I guess which you participated in. Do you recall this?
Very, very vaguely.
Oh, okay. But in any event, what they're an attempt to kind of grapple with a broad framework for understanding what's an appropriate strategic policy for the country. But in reading through them, you see the difficulty that people have when there is very little data to work with and everybody has a set of assumptions and they're trying to bring it together and make something sensible out
yes.
of it. But if you don't recall that particular experience, maybe it's not worth going into, but that struck me as an interesting example on one end of the spectrum of trying to, at this point, kind of to really develop a set of assumptions that you feel comfortable with to build a study on. This is kind of the formative mm-hmm. stage of that process.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you... Well, let me pose it a different way. You know, you came, you know, from the Lincoln Labs and then the business activity that you were doing in Paris. And I would surmise that your experience at Lincoln Labs, I mean, this is a laboratory, it's kind of hard-nosed, you're doing experiments, you know, you're trying to develop particular sets of hardware for particular needs, and, you know, it's an experimental situation where data is very important and reaching a particular end is very important. What were your perceptions when you began to see people who were grappling with a different kind of problem? And I think probably the nuclear strategy is the best example to highlight here, in which, you know, the model of the laboratory just doesn't work very well, and it's much more fluid in attempting to understand what's going on and come up with a reasonable position or policy in this area. I mean, what was your response to the kind of thinking that was here at RAND in those areas?
Well, of course, the first study I engaged in had many of those
right.
characteristics.
Right.
And the first thing I recognized was, you know, that here are extremely important problems in which you can't go out and get the numbers, so you have to make assumptions about them. And then it's important, as I said, to have a number of assumptions and to try to, no matter how many you have, make them explicit and generate some understanding of their reasonableness. And then to see what the link between them and the conclusion is. Although I myself have always had a bias toward the empirical approach, try to seek data wherever I can find them. You're quite right. There are situations in which you can't do that, and therefore, as long as you make the assumptions explicit, I think that's the best you can do. But it does lead to, again, now that's where I get conflicted. And the best example I can give you of that is a meeting of the RAND Board of Trustees when Don Rice was president, at which Don had a policy which didn't make much sense to me, but I couldn't argue him out of it, of presenting the board with a mixed menu of subjects. You'd have a briefing on, anti-satellite operations, followed by a briefing on education. And the first briefing was essentially data-free. mean, it contained a whole bunch of assumptions about performance characteristics of systems that didn't exist, and put them out in space and played games with them, and came out with a whole set of very neat, precise, four decimal point place ordered conclusions. And that was followed by a briefing on education in New York City or some such subject, which, in contrast to the first briefing, looked like absolute mush. And the comment of the board was, actually they addressed it to me because I was then the head of the domestic division. They said, how can you produce such a study when you have the perfect example of the kind of study that ought to be done immediately preceding it? And that is the study of the anti-satellite systems. And so we got into a long discussion about the inherent message, inherent difficulty of dealing with anything that involves so many human beings in complex social systems as opposed to engineering systems or physical characteristics in which you simply assume away all the uncertainties by assigning probabilities of reliability of this, that, and the other thing, where you can anybody can calculate trajectories. And it was the perfect example of the difference between, of the speciousness of the argument, if we can send a man to the moon, we can certainly clean up New York City. Right. And that's about the best I could do with that one. But, I said to myself, it's awful easy to do a study when it's totally data-free and you can just make all the assumptions then it's just a matter of mathematics. And it comes out looking awfully neat and crisp, and it may be totally unreal. Whereas where you have a real problem, by the very fact that it's real and living and dynamic, it's often so messy that by the time you get an understanding of it, or you make some assumptions about it, or you get some data about it, you're already wrong. And because the world moves on, it's not governed by physical constants or the motions of the planets or whatever. It's governed by people like you and me. So, and that's always been a difference between the domestic division and the national security division, at the extremes, always. Some of the domestic studies are extraordinarily messy and complex, you really don't know what. It was very clear. I saw a television program the other night on which 20th Century on public broadcasting, which dealt with criminal justice and the violent criminal. And the program was divided into two halves. And the first half dealt with a scientific analysis of the role of certain chemicals in the brain, the presence or absence thereof, in relation to being violence prone. And the second half of the program was devoted to the social science implications. And Joan Peterselia, who was the head of RAND's, I didn't know she was going to be on this, it was a complete surprise, the head of RAND's criminal justice program was one of the two discussants, and the other was a judge who was actually engaged in the business of sentencing violent criminals. And the first half of the program was clear, concise. You could see the experimental data. You could see where they came from. You could observe the behavior of the monkeys that they were dealing with. And then you could see the tests that they were doing with people. And you found that there was a correlation of such and such between certain levels of chemicals and being violence prone. And the man comes on the screen and he says, I can hardly wait to get my hands on somebody and wring his neck. It gives me such a wonderful feeling, and I don't understand it. And then they take him out and they test his fluids, and lo and behold, they're very low. And so this is partly curable maybe by diet, partly curable maybe by injection, and so on. But that's the science, the physical science approach. Then this was followed by a discussion by the judge, who said, in effect, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I can't believe anybody. And so I get up there, and all I can do is really follow my intuition. I can look at the person's past record, and then I say to myself, well, is it really fair to really hit him because of that or whatever? And anyhow, somehow I arbitrarily make a decision, and the guy either gets 30 days or 30 years or walks out of my court a free man. And Peter Cilia talked about the you know, all of the difficulties and risks involved in identifying people who are violence prone. Does the fact that you're violence prone, you were violence prone yesterday, mean that you will be violence prone tomorrow? The key question is, what's the probability? And then you're mixed up in questions of equity, and, you know, all right, you're back with the judge. And the contrast between the two approaches was so stark to me that was the main point I drew from the program. And you could tell that the physical scientists, they were loving what they were doing. I mean, they were enjoying every minute of it. They were ebullient, and they were enthusiastic, and so on. And the judge and Joan seemed pained because they couldn't do better, because they're dealing with real people, and they're dealing with questions of values and equity and risk, the risk of doing an injustice. And I suppose RAND ought to devote more of its attention to trying to bring those two things together, and I guess it's fair to say we have. But we're not there yet by any means.
Okay. But I wanted to go back and get your impressions of this ferment of interest at RAND when you came here of nuclear strategy issues. I mean, I assume this was a new thing that you were exposed to. And just how you view the character of the discussions and how much you came to accept one approach to dealing with these kinds of issues, you know, versus another.
Well, the issues were, in essence, new to me. Research on them was, in essence, new to me. But I really didn't believe in the validity of any single method. I mean, I believe that you address the problem in the best possible way. And if there are data available to you or you can generate data, you ought to do that and use them. But if they're not, and the problems are really important, such as these are, you do the best you can. And you bounce ideas off each other and to test the reasonableness of your kind of going in points, as that seminar suggests. And then once you think you have something reasonable, you begin to argue from those bases and always qualify your conclusions by saying how sensitive they are to where you are going in. So I was really struck by the brightness, what I conceived to be the brightness and the high quality of the people I ran into who were working in the strategic area. And, I somehow was able to embrace, or at least to understand, the criticisms of a Salugar at one end of the spectrum, but to admire the accomplishments of a Wohlstetter at the other. And I really mean that as I think something that is very useful to a RAND citizen, and that is to be able to appreciate the utility of a broad variety of research techniques, and that you have to draw on what you've got in order to address important problems. And I saw RAND as being particularly ingenious in using bright people in doing that, and that's what persuaded me really to come here and stay. Was really the quality of the people, their intelligence, and their dedication to what they were doing. They would go to any lengths to avoid being dishonest, to be upfront, that combined with the importance of the problems and the various ways in which they were going about it, and their inherent intelligence and decency, in most cases, is what convinced me this was a wonderful institution with of great potential. So I was very positively attracted by the broad variety of approaches, and didn't find myself stuck with, unless you can, show me that I'm skeptical. I found myself sometimes uncomfortable, but certainly understanding the need for making assumptions and basing grand outcomes on assumptions. Okay. And, the classic example of that in Rand, in all of Rand, I suppose, is the fundamental assumption that underlies every Rand study in the strategic area, which is the rationality of our opponent. And all Rand studies suffer from that same basic assumption. We always assume a rational enemy. And that's one assumption I really do question. And I remember being in the Pentagon once during the Vietnam War and talking with a general who was a good friend of mine who was in international security affairs at the time. And he said, "We're sending them signals, we're sending them signals, we're sending them signals day after day after day. They don't seem to understand." And I said to him, "Did you ever think, A, that they're not listening, or B, they don't care?" And he stopped and he said, "But that wouldn't be rational." And I said, "Well, on what rational basis would a country like Vietnam stand up against the United States?" And, you have to admit that's fairly irrational by our standards. And that's not an assumption which one tends to make in studying education or in studying the bureaucracy. I think a lot of irrational things come out, and I think they have to be taken account of. But as long as people realize that that's the assumption, and it may be wrong, that you may have a Saddam Hussein, just to take a live example. That's got to be an irrational behavior on his part, not today to pull those troops out of Kuwait, or yesterday, or starting last night, or sometime, or else, unless he has some surprises that I don't think he has. He's going to take it. It's simply not rational to expect to prevail in that kind of situation, in any definition of prevailing that we would consider rational. I hope I'm right. I'm not at all sure.
Well, maybe this would be a good stopping point for our discussion. Okay.
All right. So I will.